Welcome back, folks. Excuse me. We are joined by Guy Williams, President, Gulf Coast Bank and Trust. He joins us every Monday at this time, and we thank him for same. Guy, welcome to the show.
Oh, you're very welcome. It's good to be with you.
A lot of messaging in and around the Federal Reserve and where they're moving. The jobs report that comes out last week, a lot of folks are interpreting that as being favorable and are wondering whether or not there's going to be any additional cuts. There is some talk about maybe possibly one in June, but it's not a certainty, and the speculation is rising. Tell us about it.
Really is. Federal Reserve minutes are pretty interesting. We get them about 6 weeks after the meetings. And the interesting thing about this set of minutes is they basically said, there's really no reason for us to cut rates right now. Inflation is looking pretty sticky. Economy is looking pretty strong. There's a lot of uncertainty going forward. But the market expects us to cut, so let's go ahead and do a 25 basis point cut, which is what they did. Well, now, in the speeches that the board members give around the country, pretty much all of them are saying, you know, there's really no reason right now to have any cuts. This is exactly what they said behind closed doors 6 weeks ago, but now they're saying it publicly. And they're suggesting that the Fed needs to just wait and see. And there are a lot of reasons why they should wait and see. One is the jobs report was much better than expected. They were looking for a relatively skinny 165,000 new jobs. They ended up with 256,000 new jobs. That's actually a good thing. That means the economy is doing well. But it means that you don't need to cut rates to stimulate an economy that's already doing pretty well. The other thing is inflation, and they just cannot seem to get this right. Inflation is still a problem, and it remains a challenge because the CPI inflation is still very high at 2.7% and rising. And what's more concerning is the core, which they like to look at, is 3.3. So if your core is 3.3, your CPI is 2.7 and rising from a previous 2.6, you really haven't stamped out inflation. And what they absolutely don't want to do is have to raise rates again. So I'd say the odds of a rate raise in the short run are very low. Two banks have even suggested, Deutsche Bank and B of A, said, you know, there may not be any rate cuts for the rest of the year. So we're just going to have to wait and see. But right now, my money's on no rate cuts for at least the next 6 months.
So is it safe to say the markets are spooked? It seems as though it's all over the map right now.
It is. And you've got the good news is bad news syndrome. So the economy's growing, and therefore stocks have to fall. Well, actually, if the economy's growing, stocks should be going up. There was a little bit of hope that, you know, lower rates would push more people into the stock market. But there's also tremendous uncertainty because, you know, we have a change of administration, and it's not a secret. You know, in very short term, we'll have a new president. And so folks that are going out find it in their best interest to say that things will be much worse when the new people take over. And this happens with every change of administration. The folks going out, particularly, especially if it's a change in party, want to tout their accomplishments and suggest that the next group won't do as well and maybe will do a terrible job. So there's a lot of uncertainty as to what will happen. We also don't know, you know, there's really no Washington update at this point because we don't really have a plan yet. We don't know if we're going to have one big bill, two bills. You know, we just don't know what's going to happen when we start the new administration. We do know they're better organized than last time. The cabinet nominees are ready. They're teed up for approval. And so the uncertainty is just not knowing what comes next. The Republicans, Mike Johnson from Louisiana, is really in a tough situation because he has a very skinny majority. I mean, super skinny. Right now, only one congressman because of two people going from Congress to the administration. Now, that'll grow to 3, but that's still a very small majority. So I think the uncertainty is just no one really knows what comes next. And then you have the international issues. You know, we don't know how Ukraine plays out. We don't know what's going to happen in the Middle East, and China's an ongoing challenge.
So, Guy, there was an article in the Wall Street Journal yesterday, and it was talking about this bond sell-off that's kind of, they say, entitled is Rocking the World. You might want to take the other side. But about halfway through the article, they made a statement, all of this might have to do with interest rates after all. I'm sure you read the article. What did you make of that, where, you know, the recent rise in the yields doesn't appear to reflect the expectations of stronger economic growth? Is there hesitancy?
Well, you've got a couple of things going on. One is the bond markets, and one of the phrases they used is the bond market temper tantrum, which really is inappropriate in financial reporting. The bond market is just literally millions of individual decisions to buy or sell bonds. The challenge that the bond market faces, both here and overseas, I mean, whether it's China, Russia, the European Union, or the Americas, is we are all collectively, as governments and countries, spending more than we take in. And we know for sure that this can't last. I mean, we're 100% certain that it will end, hopefully not badly, but it will end, because at some point you just can't keep borrowing. We're borrowing 6% of GDP every year, which is a tremendous amount of borrowing when we only collect about 20% of GDP in taxes. So we have a substantial deficit, which means we're pumping new debt into the market, and somebody has to buy that debt. And it's not like, unlike any other commodity, if you create more and more debt and you're asking people to buy more and more, at some point the price has to change, and the price is the interest rate. So we're seeing long-term interest rates go up. And the reason is, A, we have a good economy, but B, we're borrowing money every year. And it doesn't matter which party is in power. We've had very little move to reduce deficits. Now, there is some talk that will occur with this incoming administration, but it's really too early to tell until we actually see the policies put in place and see the budget presented. And that's what the markets are nervous about, is this tremendous debt overhang.
Yeah, it's going to be it's funny, and I've said this before, and you've heard me say it, the more I read, the more confused I get. I feel like, you know, the finger on Mercury, you know, every time you think you've got it figured out and you're charting it out, and it's like, nah, it just slides to the right, slides to the left.
Yeah, and I think the thing that the politicians on the right, left, and center don't really want to explain is, folks, we can't keep living the way we're living. There will have to be some changes that will be painful. And the changes can either be in reduced government spending and programs that people really like, or in increased taxes, which people don't like. So either way, the voters are going to be unhappy. They're either going to be unhappy because they lose programs that they become attached to, or they're going to be unhappy because they're paying higher taxes. And it can't just be the billionaires, because there's not enough money there. You can't tax them enough. It has to filter down to the middle class and to normal folks. And that's the tough message. It's hard to present that during a campaign. And, you know, it's just one of those challenges politically. If you tell the truth sometimes in D.C., that's a quick route to getting out of office.
Let's pivot to China real quick. Guy, while we're on economies, yesterday China announces that its trade surplus reached almost $1 trillion last year, which is one of the highest trade surpluses I think ever reported in the history of the world. I guess we don't know whether that's actually true. Your thoughts?
Yeah, China is an interesting country, and it's really facing some challenges. I mean, the trade surplus looks great. If you're Chinese, you think this is wonderful. We're selling stuff to the rest of the world. But if you dig under the surface, China has some real problems. One is the rest of the world is beginning to sour on their relationship with China. And, you know, Exhibit A is Germany. Germany thought, you know, that we'll have a great deal with China. We'll build car plants in China. We'll do joint ventures because that's how you do business in China. We'll ship machine tools to China, but it's a big market, and we'll sell lots of things to China. What Germany didn't realize is the Chinese plan was you'll have joint ventures, you'll ship us machine tools, we'll steal your technology, we will start making machine tools here, and then we will export your technology to the rest of the world and undercut your pricing. And that's how you get a trade surplus as big as China has, a big leap forward by stealing technology. And then in the auto business, the same thing. Once they had the technology, they created very inexpensive vehicles and started exporting them to the rest of the world. And European Union can have tariffs on cars, which they do, but the rest of the world is eager to get the cheapest thing possible. And so what China's doing is sending very inexpensive exports around the world using technology that they stole from the developed world. And even the lesser developed countries, the Indias and Indonesias, are not happy because they're looking at China sending inexpensive goods to their country and displacing their manufacturers. And the challenge is this is really the only high point in the Chinese economy. Chinese economy is not growing as fast as the U.S. economy, which is really tough for China to admit. There's a Chinese economist, Zhao Xiwen, who is with the central bank, and a week ago, he actually got in real trouble for telling the truth. And what he said was, if you look at utility utilization, if you look at the train travel, port travel, if you look at employment data, the Chinese economy has really grown about 2% each of the last 3 years, not 5. And he was summoned back to China and has been silenced. Now, he still has his job, but he's not allowed to speak publicly. And I'm sure after about a year and a half of re-education, he'll come back and understand that President Xi was always right. And, you know, these numbers just that he said were a mistake. But it's an example of what happens when somebody actually tells the truth about the Chinese economy, which is it's not in great shape. And demographically, they're facing a big challenge because the population shrinks every year.
It's interesting that they believe that they can lie to the rest of the world. And I know for a long time people believed it, but is there any place now where folks don't get the sense that they look at everything that China says with a jaded eye?
Well, I think the good thing is people have wised up. I mean, look, we thought, and I'm one of those people who thought it, I really believe that when we opened up relations with China, that inevitably an economic union would lead to more democracy, would lead to a rules-based trade, and that, you know, life would be good. And it turned out that what China wanted was access to the other markets. They had zero interest in obeying the rules and zero interest in democracy. They're absolutely intent on controlling things. And President Xi's even gotten rid of what level of democracy there used to be within the Communist Party. There used to be term limits, and so if you were party chairman, you could serve for 2 terms, and then you had to step out. Well, he put in a law that he can serve forever. So he has no term limits. He's gotten rid of democracy. And when he says 5% is the growth target, everybody has to salute the flag and say 5%. The good thing for the rest of the world is there are now ways to measure that. One is you can look at the light emitted from cities. You can look at the train travel with satellites. You can look at the ship travel with satellites. And the rest of the world is agreeing with gouge them in and saying, you know, China's really not growing at the rate they say they are. And it's pretty much imaginary. And the government really is facing some big challenges, which, you know, makes it a very tough time to negotiate with them, because they're living in their own dream world, and nobody can tell President Xi anything that he doesn't want to hear.
Guy, does this highlight or put more pressure on making sure that we get these tariffs right? Because it seems to me that China kind of looks at us and others and looks at our failures. And in a New York Times article yesterday, there was an observation made that the failures of both Boeing and Airbus to a lesser extent, that China's now in the process of wanting to develop single-aisle commercial jetliners. And, you know, they just kind of study our failures, and when they see that there's a crack in the market and an opportunity, they obviously can respond at a much quicker rate than either France or the U.S. or Germany or others, and they step in. But I guess the question should be, does this really make it more important for us to be in lockstep with our allies as it relates to China?
It does, and I think it's very important for the G20 countries to get together and say, look, we need to enforce the free trade agreements that China signed voluntarily. You know, they agreed to certain rules of the road. They have to actually follow them. And that's something that we've never done. The Europeans have never done it. The U.S. has never done it. And, you know, we really didn't want to call China on their violations. And I think it's time to say, look, if you want to stay in the World Trade Agreement, you have to obey the rules. You can't be the only one that just ignores it and does things the way you want. I mean, one example, and it's a small but big example, is that Shein fast fashion company. You know, they sell very inexpensive clothing. They come up with really lots and lots of new designs every week. They ship quickly. But they also use slave labor. And people that have checked the DNA in the products have discovered that using China that's been produced by the Uyghurs, who were basically enslaved. I mean, every human rights organization that's looked at it said this is just modern slavery. And so China is ignoring their human rights obligation. The other thing for people that don't care about human rights is the textiles have dangerous chemicals that you couldn't use if you were here. And we haven't been bold enough to say to China, look, you can't have this stuff. You know, if you ship stuff over here with dangerous chemicals in the textiles, we're going to destroy it at the border. We're not going to ship it back so you can resell it somewhere else. You just can't do it. You have to. We have rules on chemicals that are allowed in textiles, and you're violating them. And we've been very reluctant to draw the line and tell China they have to A, quit using slave labor, and B, quit putting dangerous chemicals in their fabrics.
Yeah, I mean, it's interesting how this is. I don't believe in coincidences, but there's a whole lot of things coalescing as it relates to these G20 countries, as you point out, in their viewpoint of China. And I think this is the opportunity, much like they do to us, that we do to them, and look at the weakness of what's going on in their economy and how we end up exploiting that for the benefit of our countries and the remaining members of the G20. We got to get to a break. We're visiting with Guy Williams, President, Gulf Coast Bank and Trust. We'll be right back, folks, and we'll talk about the California wildfires and the insurance industry when we return. Welcome back, folks. The Santa Ana winds are expected to return this week, threatening to fan the flames even more so. 24 people have been killed, and more than 12,000 buildings have been destroyed. Economic losses are now reported to be as high as $275 billion. This is getting worse by the day, Guy, and I'm not sure that we're able to really get our head around and understand the downstream implications as of yet. Your thoughts?
No, I agree. And this, for perspective, Hurricane Katrina was the largest natural disaster to hit America, and it was $500 billion in damage. This is 270 and growing, so I don't know if it'll surpass Katrina, but it's certainly headed that direction. And I think, you know, first, you know, we in Louisiana know what it's like to lose everything, so our heart goes out to the people in California. You know, it's terrible to, you know, go back and find that you have nothing left. And I know in our case, my parents had photo albums that they'd saved for generations, and the whole photo history of the family just was gone. You know, good reason to get that stuff archived electronically. But, you know, the people in California are facing that, and really sorry for them. But, you know, we did learn some things in Hurricane Katrina. And so bitter experience will tell us, have the political fights later. Don't do it right now. I mean, right this moment, you have Kristen Crowley, who is the fire department head, fighting with the mayor, Karen Bass. You have Gavin Newsom saying, I'm not getting straight answers. I'm going to have an independent commission to look into this. And literally this week, and timing couldn't be worse, the California legislature is approving $50 million in a contingency legal fund, not for the fires, but to fight the Trump administration over what they think may occur in the future. And I'm thinking, guys, just quit. Don't. There'll be plenty of time to have these fights. There'll be plenty of times to argue. And, you know, if you have some reason that you need to fight the incoming administration legislatively, do it later. But don't stir up trouble right now. And the other thing, other than the obvious, look, quit finger pointing. You're not doing your jobs. Is you really need, as soon as the fires are out, California is going to need to get somebody that's an expert in FEMA, because we discovered that through sad experience in all of our parishes in South Louisiana. The president, whoever that president might be, and in our case it was President Bush, is going to promise to be there forever. And in this case, President Biden said, I'm not going anywhere. Well, that's sort of disingenuous, because he actually is in about a week. But even if President Trump steps in and says, look, we're not going anywhere, what's going to happen next is the bureaucrats are going to start looking at the Stafford Act, and that's going to determine what you get and how things are done. So the next step after immediate fires are out is California is going to need to get some real good experts that can negotiate the Stafford Act, because otherwise it's going to be very difficult to get rebuilt. And this is a tremendous challenge, and it comes at a time when the government is reluctant to spend a lot of new money. So that's going to roll over to an insurance crisis, to a utility crisis, and lots of other problems. But I would encourage them, you know, quit trying to blame each other right now. Let's get the fires out, get some experts, and don't forget the mental health aspect. That's one of the things that happened after Katrina, is everybody was under a bit of post-traumatic stress. So encourage folks to get help, either from, you know, the religious community they're involved in or secular counselors. But there's a lot of stress that goes on, and a lot of bad decisions get made because people are just operating under that feeling of stress.
Yeah, you know what's interesting in this lame duck period, which just mystifies me, that presidents have this much authority to do these things and handcuffing an incoming administration, is that already Biden passed or made a decision that there would be a 100% recovery for certain things that we didn't do in the aftermath of Hurricane Helene, and we haven't done in the aftermath of a number of hurricanes. And already there's this move afoot to treat this disaster, as epic as it is, differently. And that just creates friction, right? Because we still have people recovering from any number of natural disasters at the present time that are not getting the benefit of that increased amount.
Yeah, and I think some of that is rhetoric, because I'll never forget after Katrina, I was talking to then Governor Blanco, and she knew that I was headed to Washington to meet with federal officials because of the American Bankers connection. And I said, Governor, is there anything that you need, anything that I can ask for specifically? She said, ask for 50 cents. And I said, what do you mean 50 cents? She said, there are big numbers being talked about in Washington of what's appropriated, what's approved, what's going to be allocated, but it's not showing up in Louisiana. Tell them that if they will give us 50% of the announced amount that they've allocated, we'll take it and won't ask for any more. And I said, Madam Governor, are you positive? She said, yeah, we're not going to get it in a timely manner. If we get 50% today, we'll be better off, and so will the federal government. I said, well, if that's what you want, I'll ask. And, of course, I went to FEMA, and I was in meetings, and I asked for that, and they refused. And it's like, guys, ladies, how can you say no? This is a great deal. State of Louisiana is willing to take 50 cents. How can you not do it? Well, we can't. The Stafford Act, the rules, the procedures. So President Biden can promise whatever he wants, but it's not going to be delivered except through the bureaucracy. And this is where I'm actually pulling for Elon Musk, which I hate to even say out loud, but if he can make government efficient and efficiently deliver disaster aid both to the East Coast for the hurricanes we had last year and to the West Coast for the fires, I think we could actually do a lot of good for a lot less money, because our experience with Katrina was there's an awful lot of wasted money, a lot of wasted effort because of the federal way that these disasters are handled.
Yeah. It's going to be interesting. They seem to right now be, and I talked about this earlier in the show, developing some very, on both sides, both the insurance industry side as well as the governance side, state government, involved in exotic schemes on the government side as to how to bring back commercial insurance. And commercial insurance is developing exotic language in their policies to try and minimize risk. This is going to be interesting to see where this ends up. It could impact us here as well as the remaining states in this country, right?
Well, it will, and unfortunately, there is only one insurance market in the world, and that's the global reinsurance market that covers every catastrophe. And anytime there's a big hit to that market, it reduces capacity for insurance companies to write insurance. So it will raise cost around the world, including here in Louisiana, where we've already had our experience. But one of the things that California is wrestling with, and Ricardo Lara is their insurance commissioner, and he sort of understands and he sort of doesn't. Insurance rates follow risk. I mean, it's not mysterious. The rate has to follow the risk. And in California, property and casualty companies have spent $1.09 for every dollar they've taken in premium, particularly in these areas. And that's why last year State Farm, and they're probably having a little party in State Farm headquarters right now, canceled 70% of their policies in the Palisades area. They said, you know, the rate doesn't match the risk, and therefore we're going to cancel 70%. Now, I'm sure they're thrilled about 70. They're just wishing they'd gone to 100. Well, Ricardo Lara, the insurance commissioner, said, well, we're going to do a couple of things. If you insure anyone in California, you're going to have at least 85% of your statewide share in high-risk areas. And second, you can't leave. We're putting a moratorium on people leaving. It's going to last at least a year. So they have literally taken the Eagles song, Hotel California, you can check in, but you can never leave, to the insurance market. And Newell, I don't know about you, but if I'm an insurance company and I've just been told, if you come back to this market, you can't leave, I'm not really excited. And if I'm being told, and you have to write policies in the riskiest areas, and we're going to keep rates down, that's a tough sell. And particularly if you've already been losing money. So it's going to be challenging to have that work. The other challenge California faces is they have what's called a FAIR plan. It's the same thing as our state plan. But the challenge that they have is they don't have enough cash in the FAIR plan to handle the claims. And they have about $1.5 billion in reinsurance, about $500 to $700 million on hand. So for people that are insured under the state plan, they're actually going to end up exhausting the funds. Now, the way it works is when that happens, then they assess every other insurer. And so that adds to the insurance problem that everyone else is going to face in California. So this fire is going to create tremendous problems. And it goes back to, you know, a lot of things could have been done to make it a lot better. But you've underpriced risk, and that's caused people to leave the market.
Yeah, and I think, as you point out, I think the FAIR plan is probably upside down as we speak, and it's going to require some emergency funding because you're going to have a lot of people going to that market and going and wanting to get paid as soon as possible. Otherwise, they're not going to be in a position to really rebuild because time kills everything, right? And we've been there.
So. I mean, you're a homeowner. You didn't do any of this. You didn't write the rules. You didn't price the insurance. You're just minding your own business, living in a house that your family's had for decades. Now it's gone. Well, you're facing several problems. One, the FAIR plan, as we say, has $700 million on hand. They'll run through that pretty quickly if they start paying out. But rebuilding costs are already high in California. You know, California has one of the highest inflation rates for home building anywhere in America. But California also has incredibly difficult regulations on getting building permits. So people
Those have been waived. The governor waived all of the environmental stuff and the Coastal Protection Act in the two counties thus far. So it'll be interesting to see what that impact is. We got to get to a break. We're visiting with Guy Williams, president, Gulf Coast Bank and Trust. We'll be right back. Welcome back, folks. We're visiting with Guy Williams, president, Gulf Coast Bank and Trust. Guy, I wanted to pivot to another issue. Not a lot talked about this, but you and I have talked about it extensively, that the dock workers in the shipping industry reached a deal last Wednesday to avoid a strike that could have crippled the economy and created a major headache for the incoming administration of Donald Trump. Your thoughts?
Yeah, that's actually very good news for the economy. The dock workers negotiated a really strong pay package, 60% increase over the term of the contract, limitations on reductions in employees. Now, the important concession that the shippers got is it doesn't limit the application of automation. It just means that automation can't be used to reduce headcount. So I think what we'll see is automated equipment installed, which will lead to future productivity gains, but it'll keep the union from losing workers during the course of this contract. Because shipping is so important to the economy, that really is important to us. And our port is one of the ones included in that. So for Port of New Orleans, it's important that this get done. And it's good that that's not going to be an economic headwind as we get into this year.
Interestingly, the Longshoremen's Union head, Harold Daggett, heaped a whole lot of praise on Donald Trump and never mentioned Joe Biden, which was odd.
Yeah, the Longshoremen's Union did not endorse President Biden. They were one of the few that did not. And I think the feeling was that because he was going to, because President Trump is soon going to be the real president instead of the former president, he would not invoke federal laws forcing the workers to go back to work. And so that put pressure on the shippers. And I think the result is a deal that's probably a little bit better for the workers, a little worse for the shippers. In the long run, it's going to make us a bit less efficient, but not not cripplingly less efficient. So probably a good compromise on both sides, but I think that was definitely one of the factors that that went into it.
Guy, let's pivot again. There was an article talking about the amount of unrealized losses. The FDIC was showing that there was $329 billion in unrealized losses for some of the financial institutions in this country. I don't know how big that number is, but is there any cause for concern there?
Not as much as there was when rates first started to go up. What that's talking about is if a bank sold its entire securities portfolio today, what would the loss be? There's some institutions that if they sold their entire portfolio today, it would actually they'd actually have a negative net worth. But the reality is banks don't have to sell their entire portfolio today. And unlike Silicon Valley, which is the poster child for interest rate mismatch, nobody is in a position where liquidity is forcing them to sell securities. Now, one of the things that does happen, as we talked about at the top of the hour, when rates go up, bond portfolios are less valuable. So whatever you have in your bond portfolio is going to be less valuable because you bought it at a lower rate than what's on offer today. Now, the same thing also applies to loan portfolios in banks, which are much bigger than the bond portfolios. But a well-managed bank that has the liquidity and the income to keep going through that is not going to be affected. If you have credit losses in addition, that could present a problem.
Just wanted to check in on that. Wasn't sure what it actually meant. Appreciate you explaining that. Guy Williams, President, Gulf Coast Bank and Trust, thank you so much for joining us today. Always appreciate your time, your insight. Have a great week.
Oh, you're very welcome. Good to be with you.
We'll be right back, folks. We'll check in with Ian Hoke, who's in for Scoot today. We'll be right back. Ian Hoke joins us. He's in for Scoot. What do we have coming up, Ian?
Hey, good afternoon, Newell. The anti-vaccine movement has apparently got a solid foothold at the Louisiana Department of Health. They are now forbidden from promoting any vaccine, not even just the controversial ones like COVID. They're not even allowed to promote the flu vaccine anymore. We're going to talk to Jennifer Herricks from Louisiana Families for Vaccines about that. And in the 3 o'clock hour, we're going to talk about why you should be picking up a musical instrument and teaching yourself how to play music for brain health today. It's going to be a good one.
Ian's up next. Stay tuned. Hope you enjoyed today's show. See you in the morning.